Thanks very much, Tony, and thank you to Business for Scotland for providing me with the opportunity to make the speech today. I should also thank you for the advert for Aberdeen and the northeast of Scotland, and indeed for the Markliffe Hotel, the finest hotel in the northeast of Scotland, and one which I've got fond memories of, given that I declared my intention to run as SNP leader back here in 2004. And it's worth thinking then that there wasn't that many people around Scotland who believed that there would be an SNP government in 2007, never mind a majority SNP government in 2011, and it would be now just a few months for a referendum where the people of Scotland have the opportunity to take the future of this country into our own hands. Tony previewed some of the points I'm going to make, and let me just take up one of the points he said. I want to set out today four points of real importance for people as they make up their minds on whether Scotland should be an independent country. I want to emphasise first that, in contrary to the destructive campaigning style and rhetoric of the Westminster establishment, the Scottish Government intends to continue to be constructive and positive about the future of this country. I believe a positive campaign will always win out over a negative campaign. And I also believe that attempts to dictate from on high the terms of this debate seriously underrate the strength of the democratic process in which we're engaged. They also badly misread the nature of Scotland and the character of the Scottish people. Secondly, I do want to address the specific arguments made by the Tory Chancellor to justify his opposition to our proposal for a currency union between the rest of the UK and an independent Scotland. Thirdly, I want to discuss the politics of why that currency intervention by all three Westminster parties acting in concert has already backfired so badly on them. And fourthly, I'll argue not only Scotland, to use exactly the terms that Tony set me in the introduction, not only Scotland could be an independent country, but that we should be an independent country, and indeed we must become independent if we are to provide the economic and social advances the people who live here deserve to have. Now, after the SNP victory in the 2011 election, the Westminster government, in my view, initially at least, demonstrated a spirit of cooperation. Now, of course, there were some exceptions to that rule. When visiting the northeast of Scotland in November 2011, the Chancellor of the Exchequer declared that he absolutely knew, that merely having the referendum was putting off inward investment into Scotland. Since then, inward investment had surged to new highs in Scotland, and our unemployment rate is now 6.4% compared to the UK average of 7.1%. I saw the BBC News headlines today pointing out the continued growth in the Scottish economy and that business optimism was now at a record high, in contrast to the Chancellor's forecast of just over 2 years ago. Mind you, compared to most Treasury forecasts, these are small errors in the Chancellor's judgment. However, it is instructive to think about it when we consider what you had to say last week. However, in 2012, despite the Chancellor's misgivings, the Prime Minister and I signed the Edinburgh Agreement to ensure that the referendum on independence could take place in a legal and consensual manner. In that agreement, both governments vowed to respect the result of the referendum, whatever the outcome, and to work together constructively in the best interests of the people of Scotland and the rest of the United Kingdom. That was the basis of Clause 30 of the Edinburgh Agreement. In the event of a yes vote, it is my estimation that that spirit of constructive cooperation will indeed take place. After all, it's in everyone's mutual interest for that to happen. However, we're now in a campaign period, and a Conservative Liberal Democrat government has abandoned cooperation, and that's been echoed by figures in the Labour Party who, in my estimation, should know a great deal better. For example, on Thursday, George Osborne peppered his speech with references to Scotland as a foreign country. Let me be clear. For Scots, whether independent or not, the rest of the UK will never be foreign. Indeed, the Government of Ireland Act of 1948, negotiated after infinitely more difficult circumstances than we have, specifically states that Ireland is not to be regarded as a foreign country. And so despite the Chancellor's campaign rhetoric, I don't believe his former language represents any significant view in Scotland, or indeed in England, Wales, or Northern Ireland. And then, of course, there's been the UK's diplomatic offensive against independence. A previous Foreign Office Permanent Secretary once told me that we should regard the Foreign Office as Scotland's Foreign Service. Clearly not now. In the last few days, we've seen panicky briefings suggesting that even a yes vote on September the 18th might not be respected, in direct contradiction of not just the spirit, but the letter of the Edinburgh Agreement. So this weekend, I've asked the Prime Minister to repudiate such suggestions promptly and categorically. Or better still, of course, I could put it to him directly in a debate, perhaps in this very city of Aberdeen next week. So with all this accumulated negativity, it's little wonder that the No campaign calls itself Project Fear. But we should remember, and we should be clear, and we should understand that what is said by Westminster during the heat of a political campaign will differ greatly from the reality of life after the referendum. In the event of a yes vote, the campaigning will stop and the common sense agreements will start. Clause 30 of the Edinburgh Agreement will kick back in. And I would submit that the same democratic logic applies to the comments of Mr. Barroso yesterday. As Sir David Edward, formerly of the European Court of Justice, has pointed out, from the point of a yes vote, quote, what is certain is that EU law would require all parties to negotiate in good faith and in a spirit of cooperation. Or as Graeme Avery, the Honorary Director General of the Euro Commission, has argued in front of the Scottish Parliament, a European Union which has admitted so many countries from all points of the European compass will find a pragmatic way to accommodate the expression of democratic will from Scotland. That's someone who speaks with the experience of writing the Commission's opinions on membership applications of 14 countries, and indeed drafted the general negotiating framework that the European Union has used in 19 separate negotiations on membership. And we should remember, of course, it was the UK government's own chosen legal advisor, Professor James Crawford, who described the 18-month timetable between the referendum and the point of independence as realistic. Now, the decision is one for member states, but not to recognise the democratic will of Scotland would run counter to the entire European Union ideal of democratic expression and inclusion. It would pose a challenge to the integrity of the European Union, even greater and more fundamental than the threat of British withdrawal. That is why, of course, that no member state has suggested they would seek to block Scottish membership. Of course, in all of these matters, whether it be currency or Europe, practical discussions could take place now. Not negotiations which prejudge the outcome of the referendum, but sensible, technical conversations. The Scottish Government have always been willing to engage in these, and let me repeat that willingness today. Indeed, there would be the same sort of helpful, technical discussions which have already taken place with the politically independent Bank of England. And that brings me to my second point. The case against an agreed sterling zone made by the Chancellor last week. Now, the Scottish Government's Fiscal Commission Working Group has already set out a range of viable currency options for an independent Scotland. That work is ongoing, and the Chair of the Commission, Crawford Beveridge, has set out today how that work will proceed. In their report published last year, the group, which is made up of internationally renowned economists, including two Nobel laureates, concluded that sharing the pound in a sterling zone was the best option for Scotland and for the rest of the United Kingdom. Just let's recall for a second who comprises the membership of that working group. Professor Sir James Murlies, Professor Joseph Stiglitz, Professor Andrew Hughes-Hallett, the Irish economist Francis Ruane, and chaired by the former chief executive of Scottish Enterprise. Now, I make that point because the Chancellor seemed totally unaware of the amount of work and analysis that's been devoted to this question and the strength and credentials of the Commission who carried it forward. Their report set out in detail why the proposed currency union differed fundamentally from a Eurozone and set out how and why it could work. They also detailed a robust framework to ensure its success. Now, in his intervention, Mr. Osborne chose not to engage with the points made by the Fiscal Commission Working Group at all. He chose instead to present a caricature of the macroeconomic framework they had presented. He said that the Scottish Government had not attempted to offer answers to the question posed by the Governor of the Bank of England, Mark Carney, in what I thought was an excellent speech in Edinburgh some 2 weeks ago. In fact, the Fiscal Commission Working Group had anticipated these questions a year in advance. Indeed, the only economist cited by Governor Carney in his speech, with the exception of Adam Smith himself, it was Sir James Murlies, one of the authors of the Fiscal Commission report. So just let me offer three detailed examples. In pages 140 to 149, the Fiscal Commission sets out how financial regulation would work in a sterling zone. Mr. Osborne cited the size of the Scottish financial sector as a reason why he could not recommend such an arrangement. However, in a recent statistical publication, HMRC estimated Scotland's share of the bank levy, that's the charge on the balance sheets of banks, to be 7.3% of the UK total, smaller than Scotland's share of UK GDP, not the near 25% which the Treasury has estimated on which the Chancellor's remarks are based. So how do you explain the difference between the HMRC calculation and the Treasury calculation? Well, the Treasury achieved its figures by the inflation of the Scottish financial sector by just allocating London-based assets to Scotland. For example, the greater part of the banking assets allocated to Scotland is the RBS Markets Division, which is located in the City of London, has always been located in the City of London, is now 80% owned by Her Majesty's Government, and in any case, will soon be ring-fenced by the Vickers reforms. Now, I've published an analysis which demonstrates the full extent of, how shall I describe them, the misunderstandings in the Treasury analysis. Because the point is, until these London-based assets are placed beyond country guarantee, they would have to be secured by London government under any constitutional arrangement. Now, despite that, the Fiscal Commission set out proposals of how we could proceed jointly and cooperatively with shared risk across these islands. In other words, looking at that analysis, one of the Chancellor's key arguments rests on a complete misrepresentation. The Chancellor also said that UK taxpayers would be expected to transfer money to an independent Scotland in times of economic stress. They would not. The Chancellor said such a shock could occur if there was a sharp fall in the oil price. Rather ironic, given that this city remembers the Chancellor's actions in the 2011 budget, which caused a sharp decline in investment in the oil industry. But he said he was concerned about a sharp fall in the oil price. In fact, the Fiscal Commission Working Group recommended a stabilisation fund which addresses this very point. This fund would mean money would be built up when the oil price was high to smooth out price fluctuations when the oil price was low. The Chancellor in his speech cited between 2008 and 2009 when oil prices fell as his example. In fact, in both years, with oil prices low and oil prices high, Scotland's finances were healthier than the UK as a whole. In 2008-09 by a lot, and in 2009-10 by a little. The Fiscal Commission did recommend a fiscal sustainability agreement with overall objectives for ensuring that net debt and government borrowing do not diverge significantly. But these would be sensible rules for any country, whether in or out of a currency union, any country would seek to adhere to such rules. Such an agreement would still allow control over fiscal levers, employment policy, competition policy, and a huge range of other measures which in turn boost economic resilience. Some of these levers are detailed in page 203 of the Fiscal Commission report. Famously, in the Scottish Parliament recently, they were described as small things, wee things. In fact, they are the major stuff of what makes an economy work and viable, and how the government can influence and help business and the economy to grow, as well as to ensure social justice in a country. Thirdly, the Chancellor downplayed the disadvantages to the rest of the UK from a sterling zone. He said you don't need to be in a currency union to trade with other countries. No, you don't. But it can impose a cost, a big cost. Now, I'm publishing today an estimate of the transaction costs he, that's the Chancellor, would potentially impose on businesses in the rest of the UK if he tried to force Scotland into a different currency. They run to many hundreds of millions of pounds. Now, my submission is that this charge, let's call it something, let's call it the George tax. My submission is that this would be impossible to sell to English business, to be charged by their own Chancellor for the privilege of exporting goods to Scotland. In fact, if you remove oil and gas from the equation, something incidentally that Westminster Treasury often does, but if you remove oil and gas from the equation, Scotland is one of the very few countries in the world with which England has a balance of trade surplus. The Chancellor also downplayed the £30,000 million contribution of Scottish oil and gas production to the sterling area's exports. He ignored the fact that remaining as a single currency area provides transparency of pricing, no exchange rate risk, strengthening the efficiency of the market to the benefit of consumers in Scotland and the rest of the UK. And he chose to disregard that the UK government itself has argued that being part of a currency area with reduced transaction costs, quote, improves specialisation results and better allocation of resources and has a positive impact on both productivity and growth. In short, what was presented by Mr. Osborne was not an economic assessment, but a campaign tactic. It was a tactic which included the rather curious attack on the Scottish Government on lack of fiscal rectitude. This was from a UK Treasury which since 2005, under three Chancellors but only one Permanent Secretary, has borrowed a mind-boggling £780 billion out of a total UK debt of £1.25 trillion. In other words, more than half of that mind-boggling £1.25 trillion has been borrowed since 2005. In contrast, since 2007, John Swinney, a Scottish Finance Secretary, has lived within a balanced budget. Not an easy thing to do, given that budget was being squeezed year by year. And this almost casual dismissal by Westminster of the Fiscal Commission's work was accompanied by a unique and one-sided Westminster view of what constitute assets and liabilities. This view suggested that Westminster would decide what was an asset, and in fairness, Westminster would decide what was a liability. The accompanying Treasury paper on which the Chancellor presented much of his case asserted this point. In the event of Scottish independence, the UK without Scotland would be the continuing state in international law. It went on to say, because the UK pound is so inherently linked to the functions of the Bank of England, which has already been established, will remain in the continuing UK, there is no legal basis for asserting a share in the UK pound or the Bank of England if Scotland voted for independence. Well, that's that. The trouble with taking that approach is obvious, and it's obvious to any business person in this audience and across the country. If there is no legal basis for Scotland having a share of the public asset of the Bank of England nationalised in 1946, then there is equally no legal basis for Scotland accepting a share of the public liability of the national debt. As Professor Christine Bell of Edinburgh University wrote last week, legally, under international law, the position is clear. If the remainder UK keeps the name and status of the UK under international law, it keeps the liabilities for the debt. The UK took out the debt and legally owes the money. Scotland cannot, therefore, default. She went on to write, were Scotland to do what every country would and should, use its negotiations to achieve an equitable solution in the round, then the world would see a country sensibly trying to achieve a stable economic future. And curiously, of course, at this point, the UK's interest would not be to play hardball. They would end up with a negotiated outcome that left both countries in a strong and viable economic position. And of course, the Treasury has already accepted its legal liability for all UK debt issued to the point of independence under all circumstances in a statement to the markets on the 13th of January this year. However, the Scottish Government's position is not based just in law, however strong, it's based on goodwill. In Scotland's future, the White Paper on Independence, the Scottish Government outlined two scenarios for Scotland's share of UK public sector debt, population share and historic share. We are willing, despite the legal position, to accept a share of liabilities, but on the basis there is also a share of assets, one of which, of course, is the Bank of England, which holds title to almost a third of UK debt. Now, what we learned last week is that the Chancellor is pre-negotiating, even as he says he isn't. He's trying to make the best of a hand weakened by debt, weakened not by the attitude of the Scottish Government, but by the logic of his own position of claiming all of the assets of the United Kingdom. And that, ladies and gentlemen, brings me on to the third point of my speech, the boomerang politics, which this attitude represents. It's the inherent unfairness in what the Chancellor is suggesting. I think that's one reason why his speech has been received so poorly in Scotland. Phone-ins, newspaper polls taken after the Chancellor's statement indicated his diktat had backfired badly. Of course, people do become sick and tired of a succession of day-tripping Conservative ministers flying up to Scotland to deliver lectures and then flying back to Westminster again. However, I submit there's a bit more to it than that. No one with a semblance of understanding of Scottish history and indeed the Scottish character would have made a speech such as the one the Chancellor delivered last week. To be told that we have no rights to assets jointly built up is as insulting as it is demeaning. To be told there are things we can't do will certainly elicit a Scottish response that is as resolute as it is uncomfortable to the No campaign. It is, yes, we can. It is a sign of just so out of touch and arrogant the Westminster establishment has become. And that isn't just the Conservative Party, although with experience we've come to expect it from that particular quarter. But the sight of a Labour shadow Chancellor reading from a script prepared by George Osborne was too much to bear for many Labour supporters in Scotland. For Alistair Darling's former election agent, it was the straw that broke the camel's back and made him declare for a yes vote. I predict that moment will prove to be one of Westminster Labour's leadership's biggest misjudgments. Siding with the man who's intent on dismantling the post-war welfare state, imposing permanent austerity will haunt the two heads. Mr. Osborne's speech and the reaction of the Labour Party at Westminster will have reignited the independence debate in many, many people's eyes. The two futures on offer in this referendum will come under renewed scrutiny, particularly from those dismayed at the Labour Party's actions of last week. And that brings me to my fourth and final point. During the past year, the Yes and the No campaigns have been setting out their case. There are honest differences on both sides, but one thing is agreed. No one doubts that Scotland can be a successful independent country. Even without the huge bonus of North Sea oil and gas, Scotland's economy per head is almost the same size per head as the UK. With oil and gas revenues, it is substantially larger. We are among the wealthiest nations in the OECD. For every one of the last 30 years, we have generated more tax revenues per head than the UK as a whole. And taking tax and spending together in the GERS analysis, over the last 5 years, our public finances have been stronger than the UK's to the tune of £12.6 billion. We are rich in human talent and natural resources. We have more top universities per head than any other nation. We are a hotbed of success and progress in life sciences. We have a world-class food and drink industry. We have extraordinary potential in renewable energy. We have a real strength in manufacturing, financial services, tourism, and a range of other growth industries. And there's a future where we know that leading politicians from all the way in Westminster parties are itching to impose £4 billion of spending cuts in Scotland over and above the additional £25 billion of continuing UK-wide cuts planned by the aforesaid George Osborne. Now, the alternative is to take Scotland's future into Scotland's hands, to have faith in ourselves and our abilities, to be in charge of our own destiny with the security that being in control of our lives brings. The No campaign has no plan for Scotland apart from to leave it to Westminster and hope for the best. In Scotland's future, we set out a plan to create opportunity and build economic security. By boosting the working population, transforming childcare to open up even more opportunities for women in particular. By giving business in Scotland a competitive tax edge to counter the huge gravitational pull of London. The issue in the independence referendum is not whether Scotland could be independent, it's whether we should be independent. And that's a question about what's best for Scotland's future. One future is to leave Westminster in charge. By looking at the evidence, we can see the future which the Westminster establishment has in mind. It is a Scotland as an economic region of a country, one of the biggest gaps between rich and poor in the developed world. As part of an economic system which is increasingly concentrating jobs and opportunities in London and the southeast of England. An economy which constantly runs up huge trade deficits and which has seen a bigger decline in manufacturing than its key competitors. It's a future presided over by politicians who tell people in Scotland we can't be independent because we'll face a future in a declining working population and at the same time impose policies to reduce that same working population and its potential. By creating a new partnership between employers, employees and governments to boost productivity, by using the levers and policy levers we'll have to rebalance the economy, boost research and development to expand trade, by allowing decisions which to be taken about Scotland by the people who care most about Scotland, the people who live and work in this country. Now, we can do this, all of this, while cooperating in a partnership of equals with our closest friends in the rest of the United Kingdom. That is what we can do, ladies and gentlemen. And that's why we can and should, and indeed we must, become an independent country. Thank you very much.